From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. This week's edition of Carolina Journal Radio is brought to you by Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina, working every day to transform the health system for North Carolinians. More information available at todaywe.com. Progressives say their policies are designed to help disadvantaged groups, minorities, and the poor. We'll chat with a University of North Carolina business professor whose research points in the opposite direction. Hurricanes Florence and Michael dealt catastrophic damage to North Carolina farmers. You'll hear an assessment from the state agriculture commissioner. North Carolina voters have added a voter ID requirement to the state constitution. You'll hear ideas for translating that new requirement into law. And we'll hear an education expert's firsthand account of the process of starting a new charter school in North Carolina. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
Honeywell recently announced that it will be moving its headquarters to Charlotte, leaving New Jersey behind. The announcement came very shortly after the North Carolina General Assembly passed a bill that increased the amount per job that the state can offer in tax incentives to a company that meets certain criteria. The State Commerce Department reporting that the agreement for Honeywell authorizes the potential reimbursement to the company of about $42.5 million over 12 years. John Sanders is the Director of Regulatory Studies for the John Locke Foundation. He is closely monitoring not only the Honeywell deal itself, but the issue of tax incentives in general. John joins us now. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Donna. Thanks for having me.
Let's start with your reaction in general to what we know about the Honeywell deal.
So I guess what we know about the Honeywell deal is Honeywell wouldn't come here because our tax burden on Honeywell was too high. So Honeywell got a deal with the legislators to cut their taxes, but just their taxes, so that they've got $42 million less. And then they're willing to come here. What that tells me is that maybe we should be cutting corporate taxes even more. Maybe we should be cutting the tax burdens even more. Why do we play special favorites for just one guy? Unless we just want to have special ceremonies or ribbon-cutting ceremonies saying, hey, look what we have done. We as politicians and business leaders have brought to the community and not paying attention to anybody else.
Now, John, as you know, supporters of this type of tax incentives will come back at you and say, look, these deals over time are a net gain. You've got the jobs and the people who move here. They're paying taxes. They're buying things. And so they're creating economic activity. And that over the long term, this has more benefits than costs.
Right. So we're creating visible economic activity in this one area that we're watching with a very big employer who's able to put out press releases. As opposed to 99% of the employers in North Carolina are small businesses. These are guys who, when they expand, they just expand. Or when they add jobs, they just add jobs because they can't afford to do all of these other things. But we want to make the situation better for them as well as for the big guys. And by doing that, what we do is we lower the corporate tax rates. We lower government spending. We hold costs down and we provide a better overall environment for them.
And in fact, North Carolina lawmakers over the past half a dozen years or so have been doing exactly what you are describing. That's gotten North Carolina a lot of attention. Give us a sense of what has taken place.
Well, and that's what's kind of frustrating to me as a policy analyst is for the last few years, North Carolina has been doing it right. We've been cutting regulations. We've been reducing torts. We've been reducing taxes. So we've been providing that business climate. I mean, Forbes just named us the number one state to do business in. And now we want to look and say we're not doing enough. I think we're doing fine. But if we're not happy with it, then let's continue to cut above across the board.
You know, that is a curious thing, since the all of the reforms, the tax reforms that have taken place, and corporate tax rates is one of the rates that have been cut. So I guess I'm back to the same question. Then why is North Carolina engaging in this?
I think it just makes everybody happy, especially the politicians, especially the local community leaders, to say, look what we have done. You know, sort of like when Obama says, you didn't build that. We want to say, as politicians, as local leaders, we've built that. We can't look at each and every aspect within the economy where local mom and pops and small entrepreneurs have created and have taken the risk and expanded. We can't monitor that, but we can see the visible hand of government going to the big guys, which is what they were looking for here.
John, what are other states doing? Are they in this game as well?
Oh, they're all playing the game, and that's one of the reasons why North Carolina says it. One of the justifications for this bill that just passed was, well, look, South Carolina's beating us at this game. We're killing South Carolina in all the measures when it comes to business climate. So if they're able to offer bigger incentive packages, it's because they have much further to cut as far as local taxes and state taxes.
And I think in the case of Honeywell, correct me if I'm wrong, but didn't they have an incentive deal with the state of New Jersey, which they're now leaving?
Yeah, when it ran out, they came here. So how long do we have them? What, 12 years? And then what are we going to do? Is the next state that comes calling, you know, are we, like I think Civitas put it, are we renting Honeywell for the next 12 years?
It's a curious question. I know that you look at this broad question of tax incentives. You write about this, including the specific issue of film and television incentives. A lot of ink, John, is given to the state of Georgia. People saying, look, you know, they are attracting all of these productions, whether it's commercials or television programs or now Netflix productions, all sorts of things. But they are heavy into incentives.
Oh,
the state
yes.
of Georgia.
Yeah.
Is that why they're getting all of this business?
Well, when you would put the money out there, that some of them are going to chase it. But still, especially, I mean, films are a little bit different because those are short-term productions. They're here and then they're gone. The businesses are you know, essentially laying down roots for a few years. So it's not quite the same. And if they're coming here, it's because they've made a business decision to come here. Most of the time, it's not the incentive that's the game changer for them. That's sweetening the pot, but they're here for other reasons. Research in 2015 looked at North Carolina companies that were getting incentives and talked to them and asked them what would make the business climate better. Gave them a list of 19 things, two of them being state and local incentives. They ranked 15th and 16th out of that list of 19. Number one was having a highly skilled workforce. Number two was regulatory policy. You know, is the state regulatory burden too low? Then came the taxes. Are the state tax burdens too low? So those things were more important.
That list is very interesting, and you wrote about this at johnlock.org, actually in the Locker Room blog. The list is amazing. Highways, housing costs, land prices, major airports, all sorts of things that these executives are looking at.
Transportation, cost of living. Those all figured much more prominently than access to incentives, which makes sense. It's a business move to come here.
So, John, we've seen in North Carolina that this has bipartisan support in the General Assembly, this approach to trying to lure businesses. What would be your recommendation to lawmakers if they decide they want to rethink this?
My recommendation is, if you think that we can't get these big guys because of our tax situation, then change the tax situation, change the regulatory situation. New York, for example, said the reason they didn't get Amazon was they had to offer such a huge package because they couldn't compete with Texas, because Texas has much lower taxes.
We've been talking with John Sanders. He's director of regulatory studies for the John Locke Foundation, and he writes about this issue on a regular basis. You can find all of that at johnlocke.org. John, thank you very much.
Thank you, Don.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment.
This week's edition of Carolina Journal Radio is brought to you by Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina, working every day to transform the health system for North Carolinians. More information available at todaywe.com.
Voters have spoken in North Carolina. How can you make sense of what they said about the legislature, Congress, the courts, the Constitution? Carolina Journal has you covered. In print each month, online every day. Carolina Journal is your source for up-to-the-minute information about North Carolina state government policies and their impact on you. Carolina Journal offers in-depth analysis of the election's aftermath, then looks ahead to 2019. How will elections affect your family, your wallet, your schools, your business? Find out in the free Carolina Journal newspaper, online at carolinajournal.com. Carolina Journal, your number one source for government news that affects you. Visit carolinajournal.com today. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Politicians and activists who label themselves progressives take pride in putting forward policies that help poor people and minorities. Our next guest has taken a look at those policies and reached an interesting conclusion. He recently spoke to the John Locke Foundation. The theme, how progressive policies hurt poor people and minorities. Michael Jacobs is professor at UNC Chapel Hill's Kenan Flagler Business School. Thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here.
So this is sort of an interesting conclusion. We know, because they tell us so, that progressive politicians support policies that help the poor, help the disadvantaged, help minorities. How'd you go about looking at it and reaching a different conclusion?
Well, I looked at something different. Everybody looks at income. And everybody talks about poverty in terms of income. Poverty is an issue that should be looked at from two sides. One is income. The other is cost of living. So the question is really how much can you buy with your income? And so what I looked at was how progressive policies have increased the cost of life's necessities for poor people. And as a result, it's reduced their lifestyle. So you can give them a little bit more money, but if you raise the cost of water or housing or other necessities, power, for example, then you've negated that. And in the case of progressive policies, they actually increase the costs more than they increase the benefits.
And I understand that in looking at this, you took a very specific look at some communities here in North Carolina.
Yeah, what we did, I actually incorporated this sort of discussion into a course that I was teaching. It was a unique class. It had never been taught before at UNC. It was the first class and the only class that I know of that's been taught jointly between the law school and the business school. It was called Business and Politics. And so we got the students in terms of understanding how issues like this affect communities to do a lot of data analysis. And so they looked at the top 30 counties across the state of North Carolina, looked at the cost of water, the cost of housing, the cost of taxes, all sorts of issues like that. And they came to their own conclusions. And this was the conclusion they came to.
And the conclusion was that these policies do end up creating more harm than good?
Yeah, that was the conclusion. And one of the most interesting data points was that there are only two counties in North Carolina of the 30 that we looked at, which were the 30 most significant counties, that lost black population in the last decade. And those two counties are Orange County, home to Chapel Hill, and Buncombe County, home to Asheville, which are the two most progressive counties in the state of North Carolina. They're the only ones that lost black population.
And the implication is probably because of the progressive policies?
Well, it is. It's because of the cost of living and also because of the education system. Something else that we found that's very interesting is if you look at the performance gap between white and black students in public schools in North Carolina, the two public school systems that have the largest performance gap between blacks and whites are Chapel Hill and Asheville.
Yeah, very interesting. We are chatting with Michael Jacobs. He is professor at UNC Chapel Hill's Kenan Flagler Business School. When we're talking about progressive policies, what are some of the types of policies that lead to this downturn or loss in the cost of living?
Well, for example, in Chapel Hill, there's a lot of them. I could give you a laundry list, but one example is in Chapel Hill, there's no Walmart store. That's the number one place that low-income people shop for groceries. If you go to Chapel Hill, you'll notice that 100 yards outside of Chapel Hill on one side there's a Walmart, and 100 yards outside of Chapel Hill on the other side there's a Walmart, because the good people of Chapel Hill didn't feel like Walmart was an appropriate company to be building in their community. So they've basically excluded local people from shopping at Walmart, but at the same time, the irony is all the tax dollars at those Walmarts are coming from Chapel Hill, and they're going to Durham County and to Chatham County. And so Chapel Hill has the highest percentage of its tax base coming from property taxes because they excluded a retailer like Walmart. There's housing issues. So there's an area outside of Chapel Hill. There's a ring around Chapel Hill where you basically are prohibited from building any kind of density whatsoever. Interestingly enough, that's the least expensive property. So you can't build inexpensive homes anywhere near Chapel Hill. If you want to get an inexpensive home, you have to leave the Chapel Hill area to buy a piece of property to build an inexpensive home. And so the development policies also have a big impact. Chapel Hill has the highest sales tax rate, but the lowest percentage of its tax revenues coming from sales tax. And it's because of what we were talking about earlier regarding excluding virtually all big box retailers. If you want to go to a Home Depot, all you have to do is cross the Chapel Hill border by about 100 yards and you'll get to a Home Depot.
You mentioned that one of the outcomes of this is the fact that Chapel Hill has such a high percentage of its tax revenue coming from the property tax. So it makes it more expensive for people to live there, which I assume also fits in with the whole theme that you hear about occasionally of the gentrification, that these old African-American neighborhoods are no longer African-American because they can't afford to live there, but people who really want to live in Chapel Hill can.
Exactly. If you can't build low-cost housing anywhere near the community, the logical thing to do is to redevelop the lowest-cost properties within the community. And there's a word for that. It's called gentrification. And that's exactly what's happening. And it's not just property taxes that are so high in Chapel Hill. They are the highest. But it's the fact that housing is the highest. So, you know, when I moved to Chapel Hill, what I heard was housing is so expensive because everybody wants to live in Chapel Hill. And what I found out is that isn't why it's so expensive, because in Econ 101, you learn there's a supply curve and a demand curve. And it's not the demand curve that's driving up the cost of housing in Chapel Hill. It's a supply curve. And it's because there's so little housing in Chapel Hill that the price is so high. It's not because the demand is so high. So if you look at the construction of new homes anywhere in any county contiguous to Orange County, you'll see some pretty stark differences.
Now, I'm guessing you're not making an argument that these progressive politicians and activists are trying to make life more difficult for the poor and for the minorities. Do they understand that their policies have this effect?
Well, they sure didn't when I started publishing about it. I don't consider this to be intentional abuse. I think it's just they are clueless. I think they are really clueless about the impact that these policies have. And when I first pointed out, I wrote an article maybe 6 or 7 years ago called A Paler Shade of Orange, talking about the decline in the black population in Orange County. And frankly, it shocked every elected official in town that I know. They didn't have any clue that their policies about Walmart, about construction, about property taxes, water even. I mean, water rates in Chapel Hill are higher than anywhere else. That those affect people who are middle class and lower income households.
Now that this information is out there, what do you hope happens?
I hope somebody starts to pay attention to it. I really do, because if you look at all of the narrative that's on poverty, at least 95% of it, at least, relates to how much money do we give to people who have needs. And half of it should be focused on the costs. If you look at poverty correctly, you should index income to the cost of living in the local community, not on a national basis.
Michael Jacobs, he is professor at UNC Chapel Hill's Keenan Flagler Business School. Thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
We'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today, buy something nice, and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Voters have spoken in North Carolina. How can you make sense of what they said about the legislature, Congress, the courts, the Constitution? Carolina Journal has you covered. In print each month, online every day. Carolina Journal is your source for up-to-the-minute information about North Carolina state government policies and their impact on you. Carolina Journal offers in-depth analysis of the election's aftermath, then looks ahead to 2019. How will elections affect your family, your wallet, your schools, your business? Find out in the free Carolina Journal newspaper, online at carolinajournal.com. Carolina Journal, your number one source for government news that affects you. Visit carolinajournal.com today.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
This week's edition of Carolina Journal Radio is brought to you by Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina, working every day to transform the health system for North Carolinians. More information available at todaywe.com.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Among those hit hardest by Hurricanes Florence and Michael, North Carolina's farmers. State Agriculture Commissioner Steve Troxler delivered a recent update.
We talked about Hurricane Floyd for so many years and the destruction that it had. And most recently, before this, we talked about Matthew. But now the numbers show that Florence had an economic impact that was greater than both Floyd and Matthew put together. Digest that for a minute. Some $17 billion in economic impact just from Florence alone. And, you know, the thing that's happened to agriculture is before we had the disasters that we had that wiped out the crops at harvest time, we already had some things going on that were making it really, really tough on farmers. Number one, historically low commodity prices. We've been through trade wars. Then when you throw something like this on top of that, there's just no income out there for farmers to have access to.
Hurricanes Florence and Michael dealt North Carolina farmers a major blow.
This has been catastrophic, to put it lightly. Unless you've seen it, I don't know how you describe it. But I do know for the first time I've seen farmers eligible for unemployment insurance. Think about that a little bit, about what that says. What that says to me, this thing's so bad that we're almost having to feed farmers. It's that bad out there. You couple what's happened to them in Matthew and now Florence together, and 2 out of 3 years there's basically been no income, although the production costs were already paid for. So we need some help for certain to get this engine, this economic engine, running again. And I think one good way to categorize this is the gasoline in this tank of this economic engine was replaced with water. We're draining the water out, but we got to put enough gas back into this engine to get it running.
Troxler tries to put the flood damage from Hurricanes Florence and Michael into perspective.
We got a little over 10 million people, 780,000 gallons of water for every citizen in North Carolina fell out of the sky. So I think that puts it in perspective. We can't drink our way out of it either figuratively or literally. So we got to go to work.
That's North Carolina Agriculture Commissioner Steve Troxler. He's discussing the damage associated with Hurricanes Florence and Michael. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
A commitment to truth and transparency in government. That is the mission of Carolina Journal, and we are proud to deliver. And now, proud to tell you, the North Carolina Press Association has honored 2 members of our team with awards for reporting and writing. That's right, we really do deliver award-winning journalism. We shine the light on government spending, reveal the truth about boondoggles, and dig deep into programs paid for with your tax money. We keep you in the know in a way other media outlets don't. And our reach and influence are growing. Through all of our outlets, we reach more than 1 million North Carolinians each month. So make sure you're one of them. Our monthly print edition arrives in your mailbox every month. Our online daily news site, CarolinaJournal.com, has fresh stories, opinion pieces, and more. The award-winning Carolina Journal team, our reporters make government accountable to you. Call 1-866-JLF-INFO for your free subscription.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Now that North Carolina has chosen to place a voter ID requirement in the state constitution, there's no shortage of ideas about how to make that work. People offered their thoughts during a recent legislative meeting. Andrew Karras emphasized the importance of a secure vote.
I'm here to make sure that we keep things simple. We had a lot of our soldiers over the years who have given their life for the very fact of our citizenship and the vote that it goes along with that citizenship. The only thing I can tell you is you demean anything when you don't protect the vote. Anything that you do as far as the identification has to be very simple, has to be very easy to process as far as the vote is concerned.
Joshua Peters suggested a change to the voter registration process.
I would like the committee to consider automatic voter registration and pre-registration for citizens coming of age to vote. I think with that you can address a lot of different factors, such as checking the veracity of your data based on the fact that you have automatic voter registration, and you can use that information to kind of use a matching algorithm to verify what was registered from the prior voting elections and to match that up to DMV records or things of that nature.
Kim Coley emphasized educating voters about the state's new rules.
The key is taking the time to educate the voters and time for implementing the proper acquired ID. Elections will be here before we know it. My parents recently moved here from Missouri. They both made it a priority to get their NC driver's license in order to be able to vote in this past November election, because in Missouri, it's required. Please make sure the bill drafted is drawn in a way that doesn't discourage anyone eligible from voting, while at the same time ensuring only those eligible can vote.
Charles Dingy wants the process to be as simple as possible.
I think it's important that we make sure that we ensure our elderly folks, those who are in rural areas, and the poor are able to have access to these various IDs that have been suggested. I think we also make sure that we keep it simple using the KISS method. I'm sure everybody here knows what that is. We want to make sure that instead of having 60, 70, and in some cases even 80 IDs, which it seems like some are possibly suggesting that we have, we keep it simple. I attended a school here in North Carolina, a private institution, a great college, and I know that my ID from there does not have an expiration date on it, and it was simply issued to me on the first day that I showed up when they took my picture. I think that we want to make sure that we prevent any type of voter fraud from occurring and keep it as easy as possible for our poll workers who are going to be there. We want to make sure, as part of this legislation, that we address three issues. One, to make sure that we make sure that this is accessible to everybody in the state of North Carolina to attend and get a voter ID. Two, we want to make sure the accessibility and the education is there so everybody understands what type of IDs are needed. And three, we want to make sure we hold accountable our poll officials and make sure we provide them with the resources necessary to make sure that we don't have any issues on Election Day.
Daryl Mitchell of Johnston County reminded his audience about facts surrounding voter ID.
I'm just a simple person. There's eight polls that I see a list of here, and there's eight of them, and the least one was 68% support of a voter ID. And also got a list of simple everyday tasks that we have to have a voter ID for. Open a bank account, apply for food stamps, apply for welfare, Medicaid, Social Security, unemployment, a job, rent a house, buy a house, apply for a mortgage, drive a car, rent a car, buy a car, board a plane, get married. You have to have a voter ID to get married. Purchase a gun, adopt a pet, rent a hotel room, hunting license, fishing license, buy a cell phone. Pick up a prescription, donate blood, hold a rally or a protest, buy a video game, purchase nail polish, spray paint, cold medicine, and return stuff to Walmart. So, and 34 states around us already have a voter ID in place. And I haven't heard much of any problems with these 34 states.
Gay Dillard of Greensboro offered some first-hand voting experience.
I have worked inside the polls as a paid worker, and my experience has been that most people want to show me an ID, and I have to tell them, no, you don't need to show that. And the year that they did have to show one, it did not impede anyone or the process and cause any time issues. The most common question I have from people is that they are asking if their deceased spouse is still on the list. And many times it's been 3 or 4 years, and the person is still on the list. So the bigger issue here is that this concern about updating our database. That's really critical. If we can't purge the deceased people after their spouse has tried repeated times, then that's an issue. And I also have a concern about what constitutes this legal ID. I do believe that there are people that can get a driver's license and register to vote that are not citizens.
Jay Delancey of a watchdog group called the Voter Integrity Project shared his concerns.
In 2008, a criminal enterprise formerly known as ACORN was caught rigging voter rolls in Louisiana, Nevada, Pennsylvania, Missouri, Ohio, and North Carolina, right here in NC. The stupid ones were caught using the same minor changes of middle name and maybe date of birth, but the smarter ones were not caught. And our research suggests that a large number of them are actively voting in North Carolina. These ID cards are not a stop. They're not optimal for a citizen to have that. We need to use these as a means to finding people who really need a state-issued ID card and spend our efforts getting them ID cards rather than just giving them an 8-year card and saying, go away and come back and vote tomorrow. Let's get them a real ID. A 1982 grand jury report indicted 65 people for conspiracy vote fraud. The grand jury was so shocked they wrote a report, very rare in that business, and they recommended, among other things, a fingerprint, as we do too, a little $5 device here that banks require for people who cash checks. We recommend this for anyone who can't vote with a state-issued ID card.
High school student Joshua Frazier made a case for voter ID.
Thomas Jefferson said to Francois d'Auvernois in 1795, "It is to secure our rights that we resort to government at all. That is the government's only job." The U.S. Supreme Court even upheld the Indiana voter ID law in 2008 by a 6-3 vote. Therefore, the government has complete legitimacy to enact this legislation. Secondly, this law is a needed regulation of the right to vote. Many will say that the right to vote is sacred and should not be regulated at all. And it is already regulated, in fact. Now, let me remind you that what some may consider as the most important amendments in the Constitution, the First and the Second, already are severely regulated. First, for the First Amendment, citizens must abide by time, place, and manner restrictions when protesting. And a hot topic now is this debate of the Second Amendment. Some view that laws in place now regulating that are too much, while others, especially those who hypocritically oppose this legislation on the floor today, want more regulation on the Second Amendment, but not on voting. Last, this legislation does not hinder minorities from voting, but in fact makes their vote count more.
You've been listening to highlights from recent public comments. They're about North Carolina's efforts to finalize a voter ID requirement. It's been added to the state constitution. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
This week's edition of Carolina Journal Radio is brought to you by Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina, working every day to transform the health system for North Carolinians. More information available at todaywe.com.
Voters have spoken in North Carolina. How can you make sense of what they said about the legislature, Congress, the courts, the Constitution? Carolina Journal has you covered. In print each month, online every day. Carolina Journal is your source for up-to-the-minute information about North Carolina's state government policies and their impact on you. Carolina Journal offers in-depth analysis of the election's aftermath, then looks ahead to 2019. How will elections affect your family, your wallet, your schools, your business? Find out in the free Carolina Journal newspaper, online at carolinajournal.com. Carolina Journal, your number one source for government news that affects you. Visit carolinajournal.com today.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. Are you interested, perhaps, in starting a public charter school? Well, a number of people are, and right now the state of North Carolina is reviewing some of those applications. One person who knows just what it takes to start a public charter school is our own Dr. Terry Stoops. He is the John Locke Foundation's Vice President for Research, also the Director of Education Studies. He is the founder of a new public charter school in Wake County. Terry, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
First of all, tell us a little bit about your school and why you decided to get into this venture.
Sure. Well, my wife and I decided 4 years ago to look into opening a charter school, mainly for our kids. We found that our children's needs weren't being met in the traditional system, and we were in Wake County, so it was Wake County Schools. And so we thought that we would look into trying to apply for a charter, and we got some parents together, and we went through about 24 board members because one of the challenges of getting a charter school together is having a shared vision. And although my wife and I had a very clear sense of what we wanted for our children, what we wanted for children like them, there was so much disagreement about those things. It took a little while for us to get a board that had a unified vision together. And once we did, we applied for a charter in 2017. And we were accepted, and we had to wait a year for our facility issue, and then we'll be opening in the fall of 2019.
Well, congratulations.
Thank
first
you.
Of all, that's quite an undertaking for anyone. And let's talk a little bit about the process. You mentioned that you decided to do this 4 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So first of all, let's talk about the timing on this. Let's say someone does want to do this. This is a multi-year process. Why does it take that long?
Well, it is a multi-year process, and most of that is due to having to get a solid board together. We're asking people to volunteer a tremendous amount of time to come together to try to develop the idea of a charter school. There is no magical company, for-profit, nonprofit out there that's going to suddenly just come out of the blue and whip up a charter school application. It takes dedicated volunteers a significant amount of time to come together and write a charter school application that can easily get into 100 or 200 pages, because the state wants to make sure that taxpayer money is being spent properly. And to do so, they want to see every part of your plan for your school, from beginning to end, from admission of students to the curriculum to staffing issues to human resources issues. So that is a long process, and then the process of actually getting the charter school approved is even longer.
Terry, you mentioned a couple of things I want to get into. Number one, taxpayer funds. Charter schools are public schools. They're just a different kind of school. The other thing is 100 to 200 pages on the application. Essentially, what you're describing to me is a business plan, and this is a rigorous exercise.
That's a great way of putting it, because when you look at charter school applications, they usually get rejected for one of two reasons. Either there is an insufficient attention to the academic program, doing something innovative or doing something that maybe the traditional public school is not doing, or an insufficient business plan. And they look at both the Charter School Advisory Board looks at both very carefully, because either one of those can undermine a school. If you don't have a good plan going forward for how you're going to teach the kids, and obviously they're not going to learn anything and the school is not going to be academically successful. But we're talking about what is typically millions of dollars in taxpayer funding, both from the federal state level, but also the local level contributes money as well. Being able to manage that effectively and efficiently is difficult, especially given that charter schools don't receive the level of funding that traditional schools do, because they don't receive funding for their building. So instead of magical money coming from county commissioners for school buildings, charter schools have to use the money that they're given for their operational funds, their educational funds, for facilities. And sometimes that leaves charter schools stretched pretty thin.
So, for example, in your case, you had to actually find a building, or is the other option to build a building?
We had to build a building because we couldn't find a building.
Wow.
You know, in Wake County, we have an interesting problem is that we're growing quickly, and a lot of the good real estate is being sucked up by private enterprise. And so finding a building that can accommodate students – finding a building, we would need about 35,000 square feet for a school is very, very difficult in a market like Wake County. So we had to build a building, and we had to find private financing, because unlike the traditional system, which gets their facilities funding from county commissioners who put bonds or other sort of debt instruments in play so that they could get funds for their schools, we have to do it through the private sector.
So does that mean that anyone who is in this endeavor, like you and your wife are, you have to go to a bank, knock on the door and say, hello, Mr. or Miss Banker, I want to get a loan to start a school?
That's right. And there are nonprofits out there like the Durham-based Self-Help, which will give low-interest loans to charter schools for facilities. But it's very difficult because you have to convince them that you are going to have a sustainable enterprise and that you are going to be able to not only use the taxpayer money you get to be successful educationally, but to also use that money to pay back the substantial amount of money that it takes to build a school building, and in our case, around $9 million. So it is difficult. Now, let me contrast this with what happens in rural communities. So in our situation, we're able to build a school. We know that we're going to have plenty of students that want to come to the school, but we couldn't find the space. In rural communities, they have the opposite problem. They often have trouble finding the students to be able to come to the school building, but they're all able to find buildings in a lot of different places, abandoned school buildings and other facilities, because they don't have the type of growth and demand on property that we would see in a Wake County. So facilities problems vary from county to county, from region to region. It's by no means unique to us that we had to find private financing to build a school building. You'll see the same thing happen in Charlotte, Mecklenburg, and many other growing counties. But you would not see the same phenomenon in, say, Robeson County or some right. rural county like that.
What about accountability, Terry? There are taxpayer dollars on the line, and certainly that is a big issue for people wanting to make sure that those funds are being used appropriately and efficiently. But also, you want children to do well in this new type of school. Mm-hmm. So what standards do you have to meet?
Well, we have to meet the state standards. Charter schools are required to take state tests. And when we talk about accountability, that is one of the big accountability mechanisms that are in place that most people don't realize, is that charter schools can't just teach whatever they want. They have to be mindful that those students at the end of the year have to take the state tests. But we also have to be accountable to parents, and they're usually a tougher standard than the tests because parents can easily pull their kid out of that school, and with that kid goes their funding as well. So we have to make sure not only that we make the parents satisfied, but we have to make the state satisfied that we're doing a good job academically. We also will have to conduct audits every year that have to be sent to the state so that our financial records are open to everyone. The various information about teacher pay, about how we spend the money, about the number of students that attend, those all public record, and that's all the type of information that we have to send to the state. So accountability on multiple levels, which is what we would expect from any school to have, especially one that is not part of the district system. And it has some flexibility in the use of taxpayer money.
Terry, thank you so much for sharing the information. That's all the time we have for the program this week. Thank you for listening. Hope you'll join us again next week for more Carolina Journal Radio.
This week's edition of Carolina Journal Radio is brought to you by Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina, working every day to transform the health system for North Carolinians. More information available at todaywe.com.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.